Okay, today is Wednesday, May 28th, 2014. This is Patrick Callahan with the Westchester Public Library in Westchester, Illinois. Also present is Sarah Scotius, a reference librarian here at Westchester. And today we'll be speaking with Mr. Dominic Pesch. Dominic served in the United States Army from 1943 to 1946 in the Pacific Theater. He was born in Chicago on, September 26th, 1924. And this interview is being done for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your family growing up in Chicago?
Okay, I grew up in Chicago, and of course my first language was Italian, because my parents, especially my mother, couldn't speak English, not a word, maybe a few cuss words I think, but that was it. And then of course I learned English on the streets.
Okay.
And I grew up on the near north side, and I went to school in the area, and I grew up in Chicago, and I spent 1 year in Oak Park living with my brother. The whole family did, but then we moved back to Chicago, and I graduated high school from Chicago. In fact, my teacher was a customer of my brother's beauty salon, and she took charge of me, and she had me take all subjects that got me ready for college. So before I was to graduate, the draft board came after me and said that I had enough credits to graduate and they could be drafted and they would have to give me a diploma. So I had to take my teacher and my principal to the draft board and they explained that I should at least stay until I finish the year. And then, of course, then I got drafted.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about your parents? I know before the interview you mentioned you had a cousin who served in the Italian Army. Do you have any kind of tradition of service in your family, or were you the first veteran?
Well, yes, my father served, I believe he served in World War I.
Oh, okay.
In the Italian Army.
Okay.
But actually, he was a soldier, but he wasn't. He worked as a coachman for his wealthy family in Italy. And when this man went into the Army, he was an officer, so he took my father along as a coachman, handyman, so that's what my father did. And then after the war, he came to this country, because my uncles already had came over, so he came over by himself to establish whatever the old people do. And then after a couple of years, he sent for my mother, and My mother and my three brothers and my grandmother, and they came over from Italy.
Okay.
Before I was born. Okay. And I was the first American born, and then my sister came after me. So then we grew up together, you know, Italian families. In fact, the whole neighborhood was mostly Italian, very close.
Okay.
And on the outskirts were Polish people. And so I got to, you know, live with Italians and the Polish.
Okay.
And there's Zuma Popolski. You don't know Zuma Popolski. That means I don't understand Polish. Because when I go into their house, the grandmas will talk to me in Polish. And so I finally asked one of my friends, what do I do when your grandmother asks me? And he said, just tell him, you know, Zuma Popolski. So I went to high school on the course, and then from there into the Army.
Okay. All right. Do you remember where you were when you heard about Pearl Harbor happening?
Yes.
You do? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. My brother was living in Oak Park at the time. And then once in a while, he'd take me over to his house to do chores. And we were coming back home on a Sunday. And I heard it on the radio that, you know, that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And of course I was excited and nervous about it, wondering what was going to happen. And of course, then going to school, that's all we talked about was what happened at Pearl Harbor and how it was going to affect us.
Do you remember how old you were at the time?
I must have been about maybe 17.
17. So, I mean, were you expecting to, did you know people who were enlisting? Were you and your friends expecting to be drafted soon?
Yeah, I did. Well, my brother, of course, was a draft age, so he went first.
Okay.
And he ended up in 101st Airborne Division. And he, of course, you know what the 101st did.
Yeah.
And they went to Europe. And in fact, while he was training, he had an accident and fell out of a Jeep and broke his arm. So we went down to visit him. And I wanted to join the airborne myself at the time, but he wouldn't let me. And of course, there's a thing with the service. You can't have two brothers in the same outfit at the same time. So that would have been out anyway. So it wasn't much longer when I went back home. Then I graduated and I was drafted.
Okay. Do you, now, how, when were you, where did you go, where did you do your basic training? Do you remember your basic training after you were drafted? Do you remember where you did your basic training?
Oh, I did basic training in Camp Lee, Virginia.
Okay, Camp Lee.
I did my basic training there and had technical training also.
Okay.
And in the meantime, for some reason or other, I used to like to play around with the soldiers, and I take them out for some dismounted drill, and they noticed me in charge of the men, and the captain decided to send me to non-commissioned officers training school. So that was another 2 weeks training that I took. And after that, I was trained in something you probably never heard of, fumigation and bath.
Okay.
Now, I say fumigation is, during World War I, a lot of the soldiers died from body lice that actually were killed by gunfire.
Mm.
So they wanted to stop that. So we got all the stuff ready to go into Europe with this fumigation and bath outfit. What we would do would be set up shower units, and we take their clothes and wash their clothes and give them a new uniform and replace their uniforms. Well, when we were getting all this stuff ready, they came out with DDT. So they decided that the unit was not necessary. So they disbanded the unit, and therefore we were put in a body of, you know, where to put soldiers but have no designation. So because I had the non-commissioned officer training, they put me into a company to train soldiers. So I trained soldiers for about 6 weeks. And then when we went out to combat training in AP Hill, Virginia, it was called, while I was gone, my outfit was sent overseas. So when I came back, I was left alone. So I went into another replacement depot, and I stayed there for maybe 2-3 weeks, and then they sent me out to the Pacific.
Okay. Okay. So the the fumigation and bath, that was your technical training?
Training, yes.
Okay.
Besides basic, of course, we took regular infantry training, marksmanship, and
okay,
so on and so forth.
Okay. And then you were deployed to the Pacific. Where did you go first when you were?
The first, they sent me to New Caledonia for amphibious training.
Okay.
And after amphibious training, then we were in a replacement depot again, and I went and talked to one of the people at headquarters, and I said, you know, this isn't getting anything done. He's sitting around here. So he asked me, he said, well, you know, you can't be a rifleman because I had glasses.
Oh, okay.
Although I did shoot my marksmanship, I was expert marksmanship. I was number two out of the whole company. In fact, they wanted to send me to sniper school, and it never happened. So when I was in New Caledonia, I went to headquarters, and they said, well, what are your hobbies? I said, well, I was in photography for a long time. I was a school photographer. So they said, we got a spot for you. We're going to send you over as a combat photographer. So it was fine. So they sent me to Saipan.
Okay.
So I got in Saipan, and I spent maybe 3 or 4 days there. They were looking for my company. They couldn't find it, so they sent me to Tinian. And I think they were just getting rid of me. Yeah. So I went to Tinian, and they was boarded with a truck company. And I stayed there for about a week and a half, and the captain called me in. He says, we cannot find your outfit. So he said, would you want to stay with us? And I said, well, all right. I said, but what am I going to do here? And he looked at me. He says, well, drive a truck. And I says, there's only one problem. I don't know how to drive.
Huh.
I never drove a vehicle.
You didn't have your license?
No, no. My family didn't have a car. He says, well, how does your father get to work? I said, he walked. So they had to teach me how to drive. And then they had me sit with the other soldiers that knew the area so that I would know where to go. And then I spent time on the island driving the truck, and mostly hauling explosives, you know, bombs, TNT, nitroglycerin, aerial mines, blockbusters, fire bombs, you name it, besides food that they needed on the island.
Wow.
So we did that. Then I advanced in my rank. I was a corporal when I got there. So we had a day off. We usually work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So they had a day off, and we went to play baseball. And the first sergeant told us, he says, now there's no rank, so this is just going to be a game. We're going to have fun. So we split sides, and he was on the opposite side. So when he came up the bat, I told the pitcher to hit him in the head. And he got kind of mad. So he says, he's going to take care of me. So the next week, he called me in. He said he didn't like my attitude. So he said, you're going to be driving nights from now on. I said, that's very bad, because I can't see that good at night. And we drove with no headlights. They just had those little spotty things in the front of the truck. So I continued to be getting lost. So the people that I had to transport, like one night I took the band over to officers' club. They were having a dance. And of course, the privates weren't there, just officers. And they had a dance with the women, army wacks, nurses, and what have you. So they complained that I couldn't find the way back, plus the fact that they put a trailer on my truck, and I couldn't back up with a trailer because I didn't know how to do that. So they complained. So then my first sergeant says, I got another job for you. You're going to be beach boss at night. So what the beach boss is, you sit on the beach in a little hut, and you, when the trucks come in, you tell them what boat to go to pick up their loads. So, and they told me, don't sit in the light inside, sit in the dark side of this little hooch. And he said, because the snipers you know, it'll shoot at you if you get in under the light. So I was sitting there after a couple nights, and a chief drove up, and I think it was a lieutenant colonel came out, and he saw me sitting there, and he says, "Soldier, don't you salute me?" And I told him, I says, "Get down here, get down here, get in the..." I says, "We don't salute officers, especially at night, because you're a target for the snipers." So he sat down with me, and he said, "What could we do to get this war over with?" And of course, being young and stupid, I gave him my idea. I says, "Why have me where I could be driving a truck in the daytime, and we have people, we call them sick, lame, and lazy, that said that they were sick, they couldn't drive, mm-hmm. and they would be sitting in the barracks all day long. I says, put me out on the road and bring them down here." So he did. He went and called the first sergeant and told him my story. So that really fixed me real good. So we decided that I had to go to work in the headquarters company and with the staff sergeant. Well, before I went into service, I worked in supply houses, so I was pretty familiar with the way they handle supplies and so on and so forth. So the supply sergeant liked it, so he said he wanted me for the rest of the war. So I got attached to him, and I learned the job that he did, and I did his job. Then I also helped the first sergeant, because we were really friends, you know. So then the supply sergeant got sent home for some, I forget why. So they made me supply sergeant, and I didn't want it because, you know, I figured there's other people in the company that were here before me. They could have advanced, and, you know, so going from corporal to staff sergeant was a real hike in pay. So then I got that, and as we went along, then the first sergeant went home, so they made me first sergeant, and then that I didn't want either because of the fact that, you know, I'm the youngest guy. I'm like 19, 20, and I got all these older guys that have been with the company for years that should have been first sergeant, but they made me first sergeant anyway. So I was in charge of all these guys, and they would laugh. And so I said, "I'll fix you guys."
Interesting.
So I had a meeting, and I told them that we have to make the roster out every day. How many people were driving trucks and cooks and so on and so forth. I says, "Now, who wants to be on KP all the time? Raise your hand." And there's some that wanted that. So I got KPs that work KPs all the time, drivers that drove in the daytime all the time, and drivers that drove at night all the time. So there, my job was almost half finished because they had all these things not to do it anymore. So that's how we worked until the end of the war.
Okay.
And there's another thing that they might like to know. While I was driving, one day I went to pick up some stuff. The beach boss told me to go to the certain, the boats were numbered so that you could say go to number 4 or number 5 or whatever. So I went up to pick up the stuff that was unloaded from the boat, and they had loaded my truck, and before I pulled out, an FBI man came up to me and he said, "I'm riding with you." He showed me his credentials, and he had a Thompson submachine gun. And I says, "I'm sorry, sir, nobody allowed to ride with us because we have explosives." He says, "No, don't worry about that. I'm riding with you." So I said, "Okay." So he jumped into the truck, and then he was telling me where to go. And I told him, there's nothing there. He says, "Just keep going." And I kept telling him, "I'll go, but there's nothing in that part of the island." I says, "I've been here for a little while, and I know all the roads. There's nothing there." He says, "Just keep going." So one thing you want to know is when you're in the Army, especially like a place like Tinian, which was a secret, you don't know anything. Nobody tells you anything. And maybe they don't know anything of what's going on. Except you know that there's B-29s going out every day to bomb Japan, coming back, and you see a lot of crack-ups and that sort of thing, and ships coming, airplanes coming back all beat up, and parachuting and whatever. And when we got to this place in the island, and there was this place that I'd never seen before. It was a barbed wire fence 10 feet high, two rows of barbed wire fence, and it were MPs with dogs in between the fences. And I thought, well, what the heck is this? So I asked him, I says, what's going on here? He says, it's not for you to know. So I went back, when I went back to the company, I asked the rest of the fellas, I said, well, tell them what happened. They said, we don't know anything. So about, I don't know how long it was, maybe a month or so, we had a visitor from the Air Corps come in, and he told us, he says, tomorrow nobody goes to work, you're going to stay in base because we don't want no accidents. And he told us about the Enola Gay going to take off and take the atomic bomb to Hiroshima. And that's when it happened.
Wow.
So he says, and we don't know what's going to happen. When we drop the bomb, there might be a chain reaction and wipe all the islands out. But fortunate for us, it didn't. But it was unfortunate for, of course, the Japanese, which then they got the war to come to an end. But before they dropped the atomic bomb, some of our truck drivers went to Japan on missions in the Air Corps as machine gunners, and they said there was nothing to it. You know, because by that time, the war was almost pretty well gone over, because by that time, Okinawa was taken, and of course, Iwo Jima was taken before that, and then Okinawa. And that was getting pretty close to Japan then.
Were you guys getting any GIs from the European theater that came over to the Pacific at all, or no?
No.
No? Okay.
No, you learn more about the war after you get out.
Oh, okay.
And do research. And I heard that some of the people from Europe, actually I think the 509 bomb group came from Europe. They sent that group over because they picked Paul Tibbetts as a pilot, because I guess he was an extraordinary pilot. So they picked him and a few of the other crew members to do the job. Now, my high school buddy was in the 509 bomb group. Now, he always said that he was Antillean, but I don't know if he was or not. In fact, his family called me up and wanted me to know, asked me if I knew for sure that Paul was on that island with me. And I says, well, I didn't see him, and I couldn't tell you. So whatever he says. But they were trying to prove that he was there, and somebody said that he wasn't. So I really don't know whatever happened. And he's gone. He passed away, so I don't know. But some of the people from Europe, I learned later, reading history, that they were deciding on taking some of the people from Europe because the war ended in Europe before it did in the Pacific.
Right. I think my understanding is that when the war ended in Europe, the soldiers who didn't have enough points went to the Pacific. The ones who had enough points, they came home, and then the other guys went to the Pacific.
They might have went to some of the other islands, but Antillean, we never... We didn't even see the 509 come in, so I don't know whether they came in. And I didn't learn until later the ship that brought the bombs was torpedoed on the way going back and sunk.
Did you encounter any Marines in the Pacific at all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we had our own war going on with the Army and the Marines.
Okay, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah,
that's,
sure.
That's interesting.
Like I said, we weren't allowed to take passengers in our truck. And every once in a while, they'd be going down roads, and a Marine would be walking, and he'd be thumbing his way around, and I told him, can't take it. So then after we passed, they'd throw rocks at us. So, and then one day I was assigned to the Marines because the Army makes a lot of mistakes. You know, that's what they call a snafu.
Okay.
And they had the Marine contingent was based at the end of the runway. Now, when a plane, the airplanes would have to take off going into the wind. Well, if the wind would be shifted, of course, the planes would go one way or another. And at times, they'd have to go over the Marine contingent. So at times when they were taken off and they have a problem, wouldn't they say the engine or whatever, they'd have to abort the mission and they'd drop their bombs. Well, sometimes they drop them in the Marine compound. And of course, fortunately, the Marines weren't there when they were taken off in that direction. So they decided to take the Marines away from there and move them. So I got to work with them and move them. So a Marine officer got me and he said, "Now you're going to be with us for a couple, 2-3 days. So I said, "All right." So we start moving the equipment and sort of things. And then he said, then I told him, "Well, I have to quit now, go to lunch." He says, "No, you're coming to lunch with us." I says, "No," I says, "I got to go back and report for lunch." "No," I said, "don't worry about it." So I had, and they were extra fussy about the apparel you wear, so they had to give me a Marine jersey to go to the mess hall. And I told the officer, I says, "I wish you wouldn't boss me so much because you're not my boss." He says, "I'm in the Army." And I wasn't too happy with the Marines to begin with, because going back, let me go back just a little bit.
Now. Sure.
When I was going from New Caledonia, I got on a ship and there was just two Army personnel and the rest of them were Marines and Seabees. And the Marine captain called me on deck and he said, "You're going to be on guard duty." Well, the other fellow that was going with me was the staff sergeant, so he couldn't pull guard duty, and he got me because I was a corporal. So he says, "I want you to, you got to be on guard." And I said, "Okay." So he brings me down like on D deck and he puts me on, and I said, "What am I guarding?" He says, "You don't have to know." So I'm standing there. And I'm not too happy with it because I'm getting seasick down in D. And it happened to be where they have the refrigerator for the mess hall. And there another, like they have to lift up the floor, there's the board. And then the cooks would go down there and get, and they'd come up with boxes and I would be in a way. So I would have to walk to the end and let them pass and then, so they complained about me being there, and they talked to their commander. So he came down, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I told him, "I'm guarding." He said, "What are you guarding?" I says, "I haven't got the slightest idea." So what he did was he pulled a vent out of the bulkhead. It was an air vent. And he says, "Get in there." So I got in the air vent. Well, in the meantime, the Marine officer that put me there came down and he sees me in there. He says, "What are you doing in there?" And I told him, "They told me to get in there." He says, "That's derelict of duty." He said, "You're going to go to captain's mess." Of course, being in the Army, I don't know what that was. So when I got out of there, went up on deck and I grabbed a hold of a sailor. I says, "Say, tell me, what's captain's mess?" He said, "Holy smokes, that's a court martial." So I said, I told him what happened. He says, "I can't believe it." I says, "I don't know." So the next morning, I had to report to the bridge, to the captain of the ship. And the Marine officer came, and the Marine officer said that he was supposed to be guard duty. And I went in there, he was sitting down in his hold. So he says, "That's why we're having this captain's mess." So the captain says, "What have you got to say for yourself?" And I told them the story about that I didn't know what I was guarding, and I was in the way of the people who were working in the kitchen, So they put me in that hole. So the captain told him, he says, okay, you're all right. And he told the Marine officer, he says, you leave this guy alone. If you bother him one more time, I'm going to have my men throw you overboard. So he told me, he says, from now on, you report up here every morning. So I went up to the bridge, and I said, well, what am I going to do? He says, oh, we'll find something for you to do. And they showed me how to navigate the ship, you know, turn the wheel and how to go and zigzag. And then I was on guard duty with binoculars looking for submarines. So that's why my first touch with the Marines wasn't too good.
How about, what was daily life like with the other GIs, the other Army soldiers? What was that like, your just day-to-day life there?
Well, other than training, you know, where everything is set for you, when I got to the truck company, of course, it's just like a job. You know, just you go and you get into your truck in the morning after breakfast and drive down to the beach, go to the beach boss, and he tells you where to go for a load, and you take whatever load it is, and then they tell you where to go in the bomb dump or wherever the merchandise was to go. So that's what you did all day long, and it was just, you know, dried and pat, you did it. In fact, they called me in one day, and they wanted to know if my trip ticket was legit, because I had more stops than the rest of the people in the company that were there for a long time. And of course, I knew what they were doing. They were going to the Red Cross Club and having coffee and sitting around talking to the girls. And I didn't do that kind of thing. I just kept driving, figuring we'd end the war quicker. I don't know.
Other than like the baseball, you talked about playing baseball. I mean, what other kind of activities did you have like that?
The only activities we had after we came back, after driving all day long, we went to dinner, and then we would play volleyball until it got dark, and then once in a while they'd have a movie that we could see. Otherwise, it would be go in a tent and write letters, or in the barracks, write letters and read, and that sort of thing.
Okay. Did you get any time for R&R when you were over there at all?
For what?
R&R at all?
No.
No.
Okay. In fact, I got the people in trouble, because come Christmas time, I went to confession, and I told the priest that, what I thought about my sins, and he says, do you go to church on Sunday? I says, no. He says, why not? I says, because we work on Sundays. We work every day.
Oh.
He says, that's not right. So there's another thing that got me in trouble. From then on, we got Sundays, we got time to go to church.
Oh, okay.
And so that didn't make the first sergeant too happy either. But other than that, we just worked.
Okay.
And like I say, play volleyball, and that's it.
Are there any memorable characters from your, is there anybody you remember fondly, anybody that sticks out in your mind among the GIs, your time in the Pacific?
Oh, let me think here.
Your buddies?
They're couple of goofy guys. You always have the nuts and in the outfit that do strange things. And in fact, had one Italian kid went to the dentist, and the dentist wanted to do something and he didn't want it, and they were arguing, and he punched the dentist out. So he ended up in a guardhouse for 6 months. And then, of course, there was the bunch of guys that got a load of beer. They got a load of beer in a truck, and the truck disappeared, and they disappeared until they drank all the beer. And when they came back, of course, they were confined to work and deduction and pay until they paid for the beer.
Wow.
And that's about all, anything that would be different than...
Okay. So, do you remember when you heard that the war had ended in Europe?
We heard the war was ended, but it didn't really affect us too much because, like I said, we were still on a day-to-day basis with what we were doing.
So it wasn't really a big deal at all to you?
Not for us, no.
No, okay.
No, because the work went on, the planes took off every day, they came back every day, and we go up there on the tarmac every once in a while and watch them come in. Some of them would come back on fire and crash land, and we saw a lot of crash landings. And you kind of worry about that.
Yeah, on a day-to-day basis, were you on edge or?
Always.
Always, okay.
Because you had snipers that you had to worry about. Driving conditions weren't that good. When I first got there to drive, the roads were, the island is a coral island. So the roads were coral. And when it rained, it got real mushy and it's like mud. So it was kind of a hard drive, driving over that stuff. But then after a while, the Seabees came and they put in asphalt roads, which made it easier. But otherwise, you get 2 weeks at a time, maybe you get to drive aerial mines. Now they're very dangerous because they're all set to go. Now the planes would get these aerial mines and they drop them in the water, and they were supposed to have salt washers in them that would dissolve when it got in the water, and it was armed. Now, one of the guys was driving that, and for some reason or other, the truck exploded, and they didn't find just little bits and pieces of that sort of thing.
Oh.
So when you drove them, every little noise shook you up, but it had to be done.
Now, do you remember when the war ended in the Pacific?
Yeah.
Do you remember that feeling, or can you describe that?
Yeah, we were all happy that the war ended. And then, of course, everybody started counting their points because you knew your points and when it was time for you to go home. And, of course, the work wasn't, then it stopped. We didn't have to drive the bombs anymore. And I was the first sergeant then, and I was called by the island commander, and he told me that I was in charge of getting rid of equipment of our truck battalion. There were 6 truck companies, so I had to get rid of the merchandise, the trucks and whatever. And I told him, well, couldn't we send them back home and sell them? You know, he said, no, he said, that would ruin the economy. So every day we send out landing crafts with 1 or 2 trucks on them, and then they get to the middle of out about a mile or so, and then they just dump them in the ocean. And then I'd have people coming up to me, and they say they want to, like the merchant marine would come and say, can I have a Jeep? I said, take whichever one you want. So they take Jeeps. And I asked the island commander, I said, now, this isn't going to get back to me after, they said, no, you don't have to worry about that. But I gave away, I had officers come in and take, for instance, fireboats. We had fireboats. And the officer said, I'd like to have a fireboat. And I'd signed the paper. And I said, how are you going to get it home? He said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of that. But I gave away... We gave away everything, rifles, guns, ammunition, typewriters, whatever they wanted. We just got rid of it. That's what we spent the day then. That was our job.
Okay. And then, how did you find out that you were coming home? Did you know the date? Were you counting down the days until you could come back?
The people started going home. Of course, they went by point system. The ones that had the highest points went home first. And you were put on a list with your name and the points you had. And then you just kind of watch the list as it goes along. And then that's how you went home. You know, so I saw a lot of my friends, you know, my buddies leave. And then as the people would leave, we started to converge into a couple companies. And so that there wouldn't be just a couple, two or three men left in the barracks, we got them together. And so we all stayed together then in like two companies until we were all gone.
Okay. And then the voyage home, the voyage back to the United States. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
The feeling must have been a lot different coming home than going over there.
Right.
Yeah, if you could talk about that.
Talk about that. Going home was number one, number two, seasickness.
Okay.
I took four boat trips. Two in the middle, I wasn't sick, but the first and the last, I was seasick.
So on the way there to the Pacific initially, you got sick.
Oh, yeah. I was sick for, it took us about a month to get there, and I was sick the whole time. Never had a meal.
Oh, my God. From the day you left?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
The guys kept me, I lived on candy, you know, hard candy and chocolate bars, but they tried to get me down to the mess hall, but it was a mess down there. You couldn't believe it. And so on the way back, it was the same thing. I got seasick again. So I spent the whole trip sleeping on deck and until I got off of the ship. I was happy to go home, but I was still sick.
What I've heard about seasickness is that all it takes is one guy to get sick, and then everybody gets sick.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you want this on the microphone, but there's vomit all over the floor.
Oh, no, that's okay. People have said worse.
So it's even hard to walk.
Yeah.
And the smell is nauseating.
Yeah.
And like I said, the trip going over, we went over on a USS Monterey. That was a civilian ship that was like a, that took people on tours and stuff like that. So fortunately, our bunks that were put up by the Army, just a piece of canvas across the pipe, was on an A deck. So during the daytime, it was, you know, airy. But at night, they put wooden shutters up. So, but when you were sick, it didn't make any difference. So, and coming back, that's why I slept on deck, because, you know, that's the way I felt by a car. And I slept by a garbage can so that I could so that I could throw up.
Well, in light of the nausea, your spirits must have been high that you were coming back to the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Did your parents know that you were coming home?
Yeah. They sort of, you know, I wrote them a note that I would be leaving pretty soon and let them know when I would disembark and take it from there.
Did you correspond with them or your family much when you were in the Pacific? Or?
Yeah, they complained about that. Yeah, we used to have what they call email.
Okay.
It was free. It was like a one page.
Okay.
And you wrote your note in there, and then you just folded it up and write free in the corner, and you put your name on it. And what I would do was, when I had a break and driving, I'd write three or four of them at one time, and then I'd mail them like every 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and I put, everything's fine, the weather's fine, the food is fine, I'm doing okay, love you all, Tom. And my sister was the one that wrote to me because my parents couldn't write. She says, how come you keep writing the same thing all the time? I said, because that's what it is. You know, I couldn't tell them that I was driving bombs and things that could blow up, or
right.
snipers shooting at us and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So your ship on the your voyage home, the ship docked in New York, is that right? Was it in New York?
No, no.
No?
No, California.
Oh,
Pacific.
Oh, Pacific. I'm sorry. European. I'm talked to a lot of these the European theater guys. California. So then was it a bus you took back home or a train, or how did you get back to Chicago?
Well, we got off the train. We got off the ship, and we were brought to an area, and we were told to strip down to our underwear and shoes. I'll tell you another story, too. And they said, you know, now our stuff is going to be all right here. Oh, don't worry about it. But they took all our stuff. All our personal stuff was gone. My hunting knife was gone. I had, excuse me, you probably don't know what a cat's eye is.
A cat's eye?
Yeah, it's not a real eye from a cat.
Okay.
But in the Pacific, there are seashells.
Okay.
And this big shell, this snail, is about as big as, no, not quite as big as, about this big. And the little trap door that they close, on the inside, is this thing looks like an eye. And I had a whole bunch of those things, and they're very expensive.
Mm.
They were gone.
They took those, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and of course, they gave us new uniforms, and then they put us on a train, and we weren't allowed, we had to ride with the shades down. They wouldn't let us get off the train. And you know, walk around in the depot. So that kind of peeved the soldiers from the beginning.
Do you know why that is? Why do you know why they wouldn't let you get off?
Yeah, they thought we would ransack the town, I guess. Oh, that other little funny bit I wanted to tell you. Eleanor Roosevelt came down to visit Tinian one day, and I imagine that it was because of the atomic bomb. That, of course, we didn't know about it. But she says she was appalled at us walking to the shower nude. So we walked to the shower nude, carrying our towel in our little ditty bags. They call them ditty bags for our shaving stuff and soap. So she complained to the island commander. So the island commander sent out a form and said that from now on there's going to be a uniform war going to the showers because Eleanor Roosevelt don't want naked people walking around. So he says from now on when you walk to the shower the uniform is hat. So we have to wear our hat for a couple of days.
That's funny. So then, so your train trip back to Chicago, or was it back to Army base in the Midwest?
No, to Fort Sheridan.
Fort Sheridan.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was it like actually coming back to Chicago?
It was strange because you're used to Army life, and of course you miss your buddies, and when I got home, my mother said, she's going to give me 2 weeks vacation, and I had to look for a job.
Oh. They must have been happy to see you, obviously.
Well, I could have joined what they called it. Did anybody tell you about the 5220 Club?
No.
It was that the government gave you 20 weeks of $52 a week subsistence until you found a job.
Oh, okay.
And my mother wouldn't let me sign up for the 5220, so I had to look for a job. And it was hard getting a job because I was actually making more money in the Army than I was doing civilian job.
Wow.
So, and they would tell you, well, what do you think, just because you were in the Army, that you're going to come back and take over the country? They didn't treat us too good.
Hmm.
Now, I could just imagine how the Vietnam guys, when they got back, they weren't too happy either with the way they were treated.
No. A lot of them have talked about how they had a lot of sort of public support at the beginning of the war, but when they came home, nobody wanted anything to do with them.
No, because you see, you're looking for a job, and people are already working, so it's hard to find a job. And you almost took any job. And then I got a job, and then the union came in and wanted me to join the union and pay dues. And I says, I'm not paying dues to you. He says, well, then you can't work here. So I said, okay, fine. So I have to leave the job. Mm.
So what was it that you, after the Army, what line of work did you go into?
The first job I had was in a furniture factory.
Okay.
And I worked there for a while, and then I quit when the union kind of shook me out. And these two big bruisers, and of course they're from the mafia. You don't mess around with those guys.
No.
So then I went to work in a rubber stamp company.
Okay.
And I worked with them for quite a while. And the pay was decent, but there was a lot of overtime. So I worked a lot of overtime to make up for, because being, I don't know if Italian families, you're supposed to. I would bring my check home, and my mother would cash it, mm-hmm. and they'd give me an allowance. No. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what happens in Italian families. So then one day the boss came to me and he says, how come you're leaving us? I says, I'm not leaving. He says, yes, you are. He says, your father and your brother are in the office and they tell me that you're leaving. And I says, I don't understand this. So I went in the office with him. And I tell you, my brother was a hairdresser. He owned a place in Oak Park. He says, you're going to beauty culture school. I signed you up already. And I said, I'm not going to do that. Are you crazy? So my father said, oh, yes, you are. That's another thing in Italian families. Mm-hmm. You do what your father tells you. Mm-hmm. So off to hairdressing school I went. What a mess. The first lady that I had to do, I took her braid down and the hair fell in the shampoo bowl. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do with all this mess? So I called the teacher. I said, what did I do with this one? And her own, she was little, too. So I said, could I put a pillow under her and it'll raise her up? No. So I had to wash the lady's hair. And I didn't like it too good. And I never went to the school on Saturdays. I just bummed around. And I told them that I was working in my brother's place. And they thought, well, that's good. You get experience. But I wasn't. But they caught me. And the, because I went to the hairdressing school under the GI Bill of Rights. And they sent two people over. And they told me that I had to go to school all week, which I did.
How did your military service, your experience in the Army, how did that affect your life afterwards?
It affects you very much, because you get used to things being at a set time. When it comes 12 o'clock, it's lunchtime. And sometimes my wife and even my kids get peeved. Dad, it's not necessarily yet, Or I am attracted by movement. Always. Every time something moves, I see it. And I like to sit with my back up against the wall so I could see what's going on in front of me. One of the things that...
Interesting. Do you think has it impacted your life in positive ways too?
Oh yes, it gives you a sort of pride that you serve your country, and in the positive ways, it gives you, you're going to be there on time at your job or you're late. Either if you're not on time, like for instance, sometimes in the Army, when you're supposed to meet at a certain point, at a certain time, if you're not there, they leave without you, and you're by yourself then. So you learn that you're going to be there, and be there on time, or it's not going to work out. So I have very seldom ever been late for an appointment, and I expect all people, you know, to do the same thing. And when I tell people to do something, I expect them to do it.
So it kind of gives you a sense of, you live like a very regimented kind of life.
Right, definitely. Regimented.
Yeah.
So when my kids were growing up, you know, it was very regimental. And I, you know, they do something wrong. I said, looked at them eyeball to eyeball, say, look at me, and you're not going to do that anymore.
So what would you, I'm curious what you would have to say, like what is your attitude toward military service now? Like what would you say to people, you know, serving now or thinking about serving in the military?
When people worry about their kids going into service, I said you shouldn't worry, because the Army or the service is like a big country. There's all kinds of jobs. There's jobs for technicians, there's jobs for nurses, there's jobs for office people, there's jobs for everything. And you could get in the Army and you could learn things. Like, for instance, one thing, we had one hutch on the island that repaired instruments, like watches, instruments for airplanes and stuff like that. Now, just think, going into the Army and learning how to do this kind of thing. You know, you could come out and get a good job in civilian life, and you shouldn't worry. Everybody that goes in the Army doesn't actually go to fight or war. You know, of course, there are those that do, and unfortunately, you have to have those. But there's also a lot of things that go on that support those people, like food, clothing, articles, whatever needed.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering then, do you have any final thoughts? Is there anything else you wanted to say?
I would urge, of course, just talking to you, but there's a lot of people that don't care of people that were in the service. It makes no difference to them. I wear this hat. I only wear on special occasions when I'm flying.
Okay.
But I usually wear the other hat that says veteran.
Right.
And a lot of people come up and say, you know, thank you for your service. But a lot of people don't. They don't care. Now I want the people to know that there's kids over there that are dying for this country. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. But they're still there, dying. Now, even in the news the other day, where they have these GIs that have that stress after combat, and the VA having people die before they get an appointment, you know, that's not right.
No.
In the Constitution, it says, and I was told this, that when you serve in the military, they're supposed to take care of you and your family after, but it doesn't happen.
Okay, so in other words, our veterans and servicemen are due to a great deal more respect than they receive.
And then I was in North Carolina. I spent the winters down there. Now they were fussing about, they're allowed to carry weapons. And they wanted to have weapons with a magazine that holds like what, 30? And I wanted to write a letter to Obama. I said they fought the war in the Pacific with M1 rifles that only carried 8 shots, and these guys want to go hunting with something that's 30 shots. What are we getting into?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, you don't need that much firepower. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you got a gun and you get in an argument, you're bound to shoot somebody that you don't even want to. So you kill a person, and you yourself are in trouble, which is, it's stupid.
Okay, anything else?
No.
Okay, Well, I enjoyed talking with you, and I wanted to thank you for your service and for sharing your stories with us today.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Anytime. Just give me a call.